From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida A&M University supporters are figuring out their next move after a controversial appointment of a DeSantis ally to the HBCU's top job.
It's my suspicion that she will not last long. At the institution, she will be a failure.
An emerging four-way gubernatorial race in 2026 complicates Democratic efforts to end the Florida GOP's 25-year dominance.
What we're seeing is a disaffection, a growing disaffection against both of the major parties.
And Florida state agencies are bracing for the unknown as the clock begins to wind down for the legislature to pass a budget. The Republican standoff over taxes continues. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan. Welcome to tonight's show. The uproar at Florida A&M University over its new president-elect, lobbyist Marva Johnson, is growing. Supporters of the storied HBCU see it as a hostile takeover from an administration focused on eliminating anything perceived as inclusive or woke. And as Margie Menzel reports, those supporters say the battle to preserve Black culture and history extends beyond the nation's top-ranked public historically Black university.
Johnson is a lobbyist for Charter Communications, one of the largest cable companies in the U.S. She has 3 degrees, including her Juris Doctorate, and she served 2 terms on Florida's Public Education Governing Board. She has ties to Governor Ron DeSantis, who has made it a mission to crack down on schools he's deemed woke. And he's actively worked to install presidents at the state's public universities who share his worldview.
This may have started with a Black college in Florida, but best believe it will not end there. So the fight that we take up in this moment is for FAMU, but it's not just for FAMU. It's for all of Black America.
Kenesha Grant is a FAMU alumna, media contributor, and political science professor at Howard, a fellow HBCU. She spoke on Wednesday's Zoom call, organized by a group called Keepers of the Flame. Grant views Johnson's appointment to FAMU's presidency as a continuation of a cultural war, which has led to rollbacks on affirmative action and equal opportunity, and to the culling of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives across the United States.
They are working to hollow out the engine of the Black middle class in Florida because they know education is the great equalizer. They want us to be the followers and not the leaders. They want us to be the workers and not the boss.
The fight over FAMU is also echoing in Congress, where Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries was recently asked whether Johnson's appointment was connected to Project 2025, the conservative plan to rescind diversity, equity, and inclusion.
We are not going to allow the Trump administration to take over historically Black colleges and universities across the country, to whitewash our history, and to try to indoctrinate the young people of America with their extreme and failing ideology.
Johnson was a last-minute addition to the presidential finalist list. The governor directly and indirectly appoints nearly all of members of public education boards. While she was still a candidate on campus for the day, Johnson's meeting with the alumni and wider community didn't go well. Among those questioning Johnson was Clinton Byrd, a 1971 FAMU graduate in accounting.
Do you feel that in this climate, under these circumstances, that you, in being supportive of Governor DeSantis, could actually protect FAMU?
If the general public perception is that Governor DeSantis likes me, then wouldn't it stand to reason that if there's that he wants me to be successful? Yeah.
On the day of the trustees' vote, they first approved a significant increase in the potential salary the president would receive, up to $750,000. As it turned out, that was the amount Johnson had requested, a figure beyond what FAMU has historically been capable of funding. In Florida, salaries above $250,000 must be funded by the school itself. Kristen Harper, chair of the Board of Trustees and a former FAMU student government president, was troubled by that.
As a fiduciary, I don't think it's financially responsible to select a finalist whose qualifications pale in comparison to others and whose salary requirements we cannot afford. I want to go on the record to reflect the hypocrisy.
At a time when government leaders are insisting that people be hired based on merit and experience and not the color of their skin, Harper notes, Johnson doesn't make the grade.
In an age of merit-based hiring decisions, how can one justify settling for a candidate who does not meet all of the position criteria, or turning a blind eye to exceptionally qualified candidates?
The opposition is deep. A Change.org petition opposing Johnson has reached nearly 18,000 signatures. Alumni are threatening to boycott the school. Other HBCUs are looking on with fear and worry, concerned about their own futures at a time of widespread concerns about the future of free speech and civil rights. I'm Margie Menzel.
The 2026 gubernatorial election is a year and a half away, and it's already looking like it could be one of the most crowded fields in recent memory. Tristan Wood reports there may be as many as two prominent no-party affiliation or NPA candidates, but political watchers are skeptical of their chances.
Republican Congressman Byron Donalds and Democrat David Jolly have announced they are running already. Broward State Senator Jason Pizzo, a Democrat until recently, has also announced he's running with no party affiliation. And billionaire personal injury lawyer John Morgan is also considering jumping into the race, and likely under a completely new party.
I believe a third party would do in Florida and in America is have a third party that would bring compromise. You got a third Republicans, you got a third Democratic Socialist, and then you got us stuck in the middle together.
Over 28% of Florida voters are registered as an NPA or in a third party. University of South Florida Professor Emerita Susan McManus thinks Morgan and Pizzo are looking to tap into a growing state of unhappiness with America's two major party system.
What we're seeing is a disaffection, a growing disaffection against both of the major parties, and people focusing far less on party as a voting cue than they do on issues and increasingly the personalities running. So I think these are kind of new dynamics that we're just starting to watch across the country and in Florida that could make it very, very interesting in Florida next year.
University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett says Morgan's view of the current state of politics is partially correct. But he adds that what NPA voters truly believe is harder to place. Jewett says some NPAs are centrists and believe both major parties are too extreme, while others believe the two parties are too centrist.
And then if you do a follow-up question, for a lot of those independents, if you ask if they lean one way or the other, what you find is that a majority of those people who are independent actually pretty consistently vote for one party or the other, right? Democratic or Republican. So they're not really true independents.
Jude also points out that a prominent NPA candidate is in uncharted territory in Florida. During Marco Rubio's first Senate run in 2010, former Governor Charlie Crist left the Republican Party and ran as an NPA, while Kendrick Meek ran as a Democrat. Crist and Meek's combined vote share was greater than Rubio's, but with three major candidates, Rubio won by about 20 points.
They pretty much split the anti-Rubio vote in the general election, and Rubio, you know, won handily.
Jewett thinks a similar dynamic is likely to happen in a three or potentially four major candidate gubernatorial race in 2026. With Pizzo and Morgan both being former Democrats, it's likely they will be competing for the same pieces of pie. With Republicans having a million voter lead over Democrats in the state already, a crowded field could be what the GOP is hoping for.
I mean, they'd certainly be the favorite even in a two-person race, given what's happened in this state. But if you divide up the anti-Trump, anti-DeSantis, anti-Republican vote in either two or three ways, depending on how many of these independents run, that's good news for the Republicans.
Meanwhile, McManus says a four-person race could get messy, making it hard to cleanly predict. A candidate would only need the most support to win, meaning they could win with under 50% support. In that situation, McManus thinks Morgan's celebrity status and wealth to self-fund could make him a potent wild card.
Everyone knows who John Morgan is, so he's not worried about the money to get his name recognition up. He could enter at the last minute because he is a household name, and he's got the money to buy the ad time and the campaign staff.
Morgan has said if he enters, it will be with only a few months left before the election. I'm Tristan Wood.
And Collier County residents gathered this past weekend to hear from one of those potential 2026 candidates for governor. Republican-turned-Democrat David Jolly recently made the rounds at a community town hall in southwest Florida. WGCU's Carrie Barber was there.
Come on, everybody, let's have a party here.
There was a lively atmosphere outside Collier County Courthouse on this past Saturday morning, despite the oppressive humidity and temperatures in the high 80s. David Jolly, a former member of Congress who'd represented Pinellas County, was the speaker for an open town hall meeting. Hundreds of people showed up to hear what Jolly had to say and ask him their questions. The gathering is one of the grassroots events that people in southwest Florida and across the country have been putting on to protest the Trump administration's policies. The group has been gathering about every 2 weeks since shortly after Trump took office. They assemble at the Collier County Courthouse, which allows for peaceful protests without a permit. A city park such as Cambier Park in Naples would require a permit. Among the messages Jolly gave from the stage is that we are in a constitutional crisis.
When the President of the United States looks at Congress and says, I don't care about the budget you pass or the laws you pass, has been signed into law, I'm going to ignore it and do what I want, that's a crisis.
Yes.
When the President looks at the courts and says, I don't care what you're telling me to do, I'm going to ignore your orders, that's a crisis.
That's a crisis.
When the President looks at individuals across the United States, particularly black and brown individuals in our communities, and says, I don't care about your due process, that's a crisis.
Jolly, who served in Congress from 2014 to 2017 as a Republican, changed his party affiliation recently to Democrat and is, he said in an interview, considering a run for governor of Florida in 2026.
I do think among all communities across the state of Florida, among all folks, regardless of their station in life, the affordability crisis is first and foremost a problem they're concerned about. I do think we've abandoned public schools. I think we need to return to celebrating public education, celebrating teachers. I think we need to dramatically reform the current voucher system. And look, I think there's a culture of corruption in Tallahassee that is evident this cycle in ways it has not been evident before.
I'm Carrie Barber.
The United States Department of Agriculture is moving to end two programs that help schools and food banks purchase food directly from local farmers and ranchers. Supporters of the program say this will make it more difficult for schools and food pantries to obtain fresh produce. WGCU's Southwest Florida In Focus host Sandra Victorova recently spoke with Dr. Marlene Schwartz. She's the director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Health about what these cuts could mean for school lunches and how this adds to continued issues food banks deal with on a daily basis.
Do we know what the impact will be on children and families from these cuts?
Well, I think it is going to be a problem because these programs supported purchasing local food at settings where it's really important to be able to provide the best nutrition possible. So schools, childcare centers, and food banks, which provide food for low-income families, are having a hard time affording a healthy diet. So the idea of investing in that, I think, is a really smart investment if your goal is to try to improve health and decrease chronic diseases.
You use the term investment. The Trump administration, according to Associated Press, has disrupted some $430 billion in federal funds, according to the administration, working to root out waste. There was an interesting statistics from the National Center for Education Statistics that said more than a quarter of public schools now offer all students free school meals through state or local initiatives. Why do you think cutting this funding is a problem?
The school lunch program typically supports the program through national dollars, which are sometimes then combined with state dollars or local dollars. And there's very clear research that the food that children are receiving in schools is the healthiest food that they receive from anywhere. These programs have always been required to follow nutrition standards, and those were even strengthened in 2012, 2013 as part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. Any cuts to those programs, anything that's making it harder for them to get fresh ingredients, to do more scratch cooking, is definitely going to ultimately harm children.
We know that, at least locally, there's been some increased demand among some food banks for more food. What is your concern when it comes to these cuts impacting those food banks?
So the charitable food system, sort of by definition, they depend on donations. They have some federal funding. They may have some state funding. And then a lot of it is individual donations from the community. That's all they have to purchase the food and acquire the food that they then provide through their food pantries and meal programs. So I worry that without these funds, they can't make choices about bringing in the healthiest products possible, and they'll be more reliant on simply what's donated, which may or may not be the most nutritious foods.
That was Dr. Marlene Schwartz, director of the Center for Food Policy and Health, with WGCU's Sandra Victorova. Still to come on Capitol Report, for the first time in more than a decade, Florida may host a bear hunt.
2 weeks ago, I personally came in contact with a bear in my backyard. Luckily for the bear, he decided to leave.
And pythons. They're an environmental nuisance with a voracious appetite, but some scientists believe there's more to learn about ourselves by studying how those snakes digest their meals.
And among the things they've discovered is that within, you know, hours and in some cases minutes of ingesting a meal, the snakes are turning on something like 2,000 genes.
And start preparing your buckets and making a plan. Hurricane season is around the corner.
The probability of Florida is going to be your highest any year just because Florida is hit by the most hurricanes on average of any state.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. State lawmakers plan to meet after Memorial Day to finish Florida's budget. They've been clashing over spending and tax issues. The House wants to cut the sales tax. Governor Ron DeSantis is calling for property tax relief. WUSF's Megan Bowman talked to some Floridians to get their thoughts.
Sarah Schaefer from St. Petersburg says more people would benefit from sales tax cuts since not everyone owns a home.
Knowing that property is not affordable to everybody right now, it seems like that's stacking the deck or giving, you know, more benefits to folks that are already invested. I would probably be more inclined for lowering the state sales tax.
Timothy Eldred in Panama City says reducing property taxes would be best. He says not all homeowners use the services these taxes pay for, like public schools. Some sales tax revenue also goes to schools, but districts rely on local property taxes more.
You're paying taxes for everybody else's children, and then when your children grow up and you still have the property, you're still going to pay taxes on that property for everybody else's children that you don't even have anymore.
Belisa Ferguson in Orlando says lawmakers are focusing on the wrong problem. She says they should have done more this session to help with homeowners' insurance costs.
I believe in funding our public services, and so don't touch my property taxes. They're not the issue.
The budget must be done by July 1st. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has agreed to create rules for an annual black bear hunt. As Joe Burns reports, about 170 members of the public spoke for and against the hunt at a recent commission meeting in Ocala.
Marion County Sheriff Billy Woods was the first to speak. He favors the hunt, citing the county's rapid population growth and frequent bear-human interactions.
2 weeks ago, I personally came in contact with a bear in my backyard. Luckily for the bear, he decided to leave.
Supporters say the hunt is scientifically based conservation. Here's Peter Arcuri.
You know, a lot of people are mentioning the 80% disapproval. As a hunter, and it's my favorite thing to do is hunt, aren't we glad that public opinion does not drive wildlife policy? Because if it did, you know, some of these activities we might not be able to partake in.
Many opposing the hunt say the research isn't there yet. Some denounced it as a trophy hunt, made worse by plans to use dogs and shoot bears at feeding stations. For many, the real issue is overdevelopment, and the solutions include things like bear-safe trash cans. 9-year-old Kelsey Blood of Seminole County wanted to speak because she loves the Florida black bear.
I think it's really wrong to have a bear hunt in Florida. Bears are not bad. They're just trying to live their lives in the forest like we live in our homes.
Commissioners voted 4-1 for a plan that includes a $5 lottery for a $100 permit to kill a bear in one of four hunting zones around the state. The hunt this December will have 187 permits. In Ocala, I'm Joe Burns.
The Burmese python has brought plenty of bad luck to Florida, especially in the Everglades, where the invasive snake has wiped out much of the native small mammal population. But journalist Stephen Hall says science is just starting to unlock the biological mysteries that allow the hated snake to eat only one enormous meal a year. Hall is the author of Slither, How Nature's Most Maligned Creatures Illuminate Our World. He recently spoke with WLRN's Tom Hudson on the Florida Roundup.
This is still an unfolding scientific story, but it's a really interesting one. And it also adverts to this idea that we've been so hung up on the physical dimensions of the snake, how many feet long it is and how much it weighs and all that stuff. And the fact that they only eat one meal, maybe in a year, and a huge meal. The sort of yardstick is that a python eating one of these huge meals is equivalent to a human, 140-pound human eating a 220-pound cheeseburger or something like that in one gulp. I mean,
it's just unimaginable. Unimaginable.
Unimaginable.
Yeah.
But we didn't actually know what was happening inside the animal while this was going on. And it wasn't until probably the last 15 years that they started to take a molecular look at this. And among the things they've discovered is that within, you know, hours and in some cases minutes of ingesting a meal, the snakes are turning on something like 2,000 genes. And these genes are kicking into action for all sorts of reasons, but one of which is it actually enlarges the organs in the snake. So the heart grows bigger, the intestine grows bigger, kidneys grow larger, liver grows larger, and then it has the ability to carve away all that size that it's added. In humans, cell proliferation is associated with cancer, basically. So it's like a short-lived cancer that causes these organs to expand. And then at the end of it, there's some kind of genetic scalpel that goes in and calls away the size again so that they're back to normal.
And some of the application here possibly is diabetes, obesity, you know, heart disease, cholesterol, all these kind of modern issues, particularly in American society that we have, that you're seeing reptiles, snakes, pythons are now this new kind of center of investigative science, this metabolic science. It's fascinating.
Basically, insulin is the growth signal. So when in the growth phase, the animal is pumping out huge amounts of insulin. Typically, when there's too much insulin, you just sort of tune it out. We would tune it out. That's known as insulin insensitivity. That's kind of the hallmark of type 2 diabetes. Snakes don't get type 2 diabetes. They're able to, again, keep growing, and they're not tuning out insulin. And they've identified a series of pathways that basically seem to control both the metabolism and this regeneration of tissue, regenerating organs. And there's only one other vertebrate, apparently, that they've been able to find a parallel to, and it's to people who have had gut reduction surgery where they remove part of the intestines or stomach for reasons of obesity. There's been an NIH study of thousands of people, about 9,000 people, showing that 85% of them were cured of their type 2 diabetes going out 5 years from the time of the surgery. So something's going on. We don't know exactly what it is. We don't know entirely how to interpret it, but there are lots of clues to regeneration and maybe working around diabetes that might be helpful in this case.
There's a growing interest, and you write about this, using snakes as lab animals. The proverbial lab rat actually was a rat or a mouse, right? It was a small mammal. But the scientists you work with and you've reported on, and you make the case that the snake actually may provide a better kind of incubation for any number of biological sciences as we try to kind of continue to unlock the human mystery?
Well, the most research on gut metabolism has been done on mice, and mice lack the particular cell that seems to be orchestrating this activity in snakes and is also present in humans. So it's an example we might be completely overlooking this whole aspect of it.
That was Stephen Hall, author of Slither, How Nature's Most Maligned Creatures Illuminate Our World, speaking with WLRN's Tom Hudson on the Florida Roundup. Finally tonight, hurricane season is nearly here. In preparation, thousands of people across the United States and seven countries recently attended the annual Florida Governor's Hurricane Conference. Closing out the program was a senior research scientist with a pretty impressive track record of predicting hurricane activity. WGCU's Eileen Kelly brings us his initial forecast for the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season.
Brace yourself, Florida. Renowned research scientist from the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University, Phil Klotzbach, is predicting a busier than normal hurricane season. The Atlantic Basin hurricane season is from June 1st until November 30th. Klotzbach predicts there will be 17 named storms. 9 of them will become hurricanes. And of those 9, 4 will be considered major storms of Category 3 or higher. The predictions are quite close to what actually took place last year, which by all accounts was considered very busy and above normal. In 2024, there were 18 named storms, 11 hurricanes, and 5 major storms. All 5 hit the Gulf Coast of Florida. Compared against an extremely busy hurricane season, that's good news, right? Here's Klotzbach.
So there's still a lot of uncertainty here, but the still relatively conducive Atlantic, I think, is one of the primary reasons why we're still going somewhat above normal. But again, not as busy as what we saw last year. So last year we ended up with 11 hurricanes and 5 major hurricanes, even with a 5-week lull during the peak season. So last year was still extremely busy. And obviously, I don't need to tell you from being in Florida, it was an extremely impactful season as well.
Klotzbach and Colorado State University have a solid track record for hurricane forecasting, particularly for seasonal outlooks. While the forecast has been off some years, they tend to be more accurate than other institutions. Klotzbach focuses on predicting overall activity level based on historical data, climate models, and the importance of sea surface temperatures as well as El Niño-like conditions. He does not predict landfalls, but he can say there is a high probability that Florida will be in the crosshairs.
The probability in Florida is going to be your highest any year just because Florida is hit by the most hurricanes on average of any state. Obviously, Florida has a lot of coastline, too.
Klotzbach's forecast presentation served as the finale to the conference. He will provide a forecast update on June 11th. There will also be updates in July and August. Beginning in August, he will also provide 2-week forecast. For WGCU News, I'm Eileen Kelly in West Palm Beach.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Evan Rossi produced this episode, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back next week. Join us each Friday for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.